From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump will hold a news conference on coronavirus at 6 p.m. Eastern Time tonight as concerns grow about whether the White House is doing all it can to tackle the outbreak. Joining us now is Mark Harvey. Until last month, he was Senior Director for Resilience Policy on the National Security Council. He's now a resident fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you worked on the government's strategy to respond to this coronavirus outbreak until recently. What is the plan? What is the government's strategy?
So the most important thing to know is that we've had preparedness measures in place for a very long time. So as recently as last August even, the Department of Health and Human Services sponsored an exercise to test the government-wide preparedness for a scenario almost exactly like this. So our plan starts out with, even when there's nothing going on, make sure that we are testing our capabilities and that they are up to par for anything that might challenge us. And that actually informs us. We're taking lessons from that, or the government is now taking lessons from that and applying it to coronavirus.
See, that's interesting to hear because many people are looking at the response by the government and saying it doesn't look like they have a plan. Let's listen to something that happened yesterday. This is the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, struggling to provide facts about the virus when he was questioned by Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana.
Sorry, I don't understand the question. Head of Homeland Security, do we have enough respirators or not?
For patients? I don't understand the question.
For everybody, every American who needs one who gets the disease.
Again, I would refer you to HHS on that.
Mr. Secretary,
you're
supposed to keep us safe.
My budget supports the men and women
you're
of the Department
Secretary of Homeland
Security. You're
the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yes, sir.
And you can't tell me if we have enough respirators.
Should people be worried when they hear that?
They shouldn't. And in fact, Acting Secretary Wolf said one of the most important things there was that the Department of Health and Human Services is in charge here. So they are leading the government-wide response. The HHS, with CDC as a part of it, has, even before any cases arrived in the United States, been working with the World Health Organization and understanding how this disease has propagated. Once cases did arrive in the U.S., they started doing genetic testing on the actual cases so that they could better understand the virus. One of the challenges for HHS has been China's lack of information sharing. It's been far too slow and not necessarily forthcoming with samples of the disease so that we can better understand it.
What about these doctors that are young who are dying from coronavirus in China? There was a 29-year-old just the other day.
And that goes into the specific risk for various populations that you have here. So overall in the population, we see that it disproportionately impacts the older. But as with any outbreak or any epidemic, you'll see that the medical community is going to be highly at risk because of their high contact with infected patients.
China has locked down cities, as you know. Spain has locked down a hotel. Italy has quarantines. If coronavirus were to show up, or COVID-19 were to show up in a big way in the U.S., would the government ever lock down a city?
That would be a very extreme measure. It would take a lot of alarm for us to actually get there. And that's why it's most important to prepare and not panic. And that's why you saw CDC come out yesterday and start talking about companies should dust off their plans for how to do social distancing and what their business continuity plans are, that individuals should start thinking about contacting the school systems, and school systems should understand what their plans are. That way you can help slow the spread of the disease and also manage it better as it does start to impact different communities.
You were involved with the response to the Ebola outbreak as well, right?
Yes.
Does this one scare you more or less than that one?
Less. There are two very, very different diseases. Ebola was very hard to transmit and very deadly once you got it. In this case, you have something that is much easier to transmit, but not appreciably deadlier or have a higher fatality rate. So we see something here that's akin more to regular cold and flu than with Ebola, which was a drastic disease.
There's a tweet for everything from President Trump, and we found some tweets that he put out there during the Ebola outbreak. He said, "Why would anybody trust our government to handle this crisis?" He tweeted, "The U.S. cannot allow Ebola-infected people back into the United States. People that go to faraway places to help out are great, but must suffer the consequences." And he said, "Ebola patients will be brought to the U.S. in a few days. Now I know for sure that our leaders are incompetent. Keep them out of here," all caps, exclamation point. He's going to speak to the nation tonight in a news conference. What would your advice be to him about how to communicate about this coronavirus?
First thing is that risk communication in an outbreak at the outset is paramount, and the president himself doesn't have to do that. What he really needs to do is articulate the concerns of the nation. And right here, it's very important to say, remain calm. This is not a time to panic. You see something that is new and that is somewhat unknown, and that's disconcerting, but we have a huge public health community that is working toward this. They understand the actual disease itself. They understand how it propagates. And we have a number of preparedness measures that are in place that we can utilize if this even starts to get bad, because in the United States, we're still at fewer than 60 cases right now.
But he's also under pressure not to sugarcoat the situation.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't say that it's sugarcoating the situation to talk about exactly where we are and the preparedness measures we have in place. We should also be upfront with the American people that as this propagates around the world, we'll start to see some disruptions to supply chains. I think that's probably some of what's been concerning to Wall Street in the last couple of days. And that's where businesses, again, should look at their business continuity plans, start talking to their suppliers, and start to understand how they can change their suppliers if they need.
That is Mark Harvey, who is former special assistant to the president and senior director for resilience policy on the National Security Council, now a resident fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, an update now on preparations for the census. As we've reported, for the first time, Americans will have the option of completing the 2020 census online. But many poorer households, which are already hard to count, don't have internet. So census workers are increasing their outreach. In Washington state, people are seeing messages on buses, senior center meals, and kids' homework about the importance of being counted. Amy Radel from member station KUOW reports.
St. Frances Cabrini is patron saint of immigrants. At her namesake Catholic Church in Lakewood, Washington, the Sunday services in English and Spanish are packed with worshipers from around the world.
Because the church has not just opened its doors wide, but taken the doors off the hinges.
Deacon George Mounts says the church has many members from Africa and Asia, but in the last 10 years, its Hispanic population has grown the most dramatically.
From like 30 people back in the beginning to now, we'll have somewhere between 800 and 1,000 typically at a mass.
That makes this church a focal point for immigrants who are at risk of not being included in the upcoming U.S. Census. Maya Espinoza is part of the Complete Count Committee for Pierce County, Washington. She says Lakewood residents were undercounted in the last census, something she wants to correct this time.
We don't want to see that, so we're working really hard to make sure that, you know, they know that their information is private, it cannot be shared, and that regardless of citizenship status, you do need to be counted.
The census form does not ask about citizenship, but there are still doubts Espinoza says she's trying to dispel. Census organizers are also getting the word out that people should self-report this year online or by phone, rather than waiting for a paper form or someone knocking on their door. At a post-church meeting, Kenyan immigrant Emily Muchemi says she's distressed to realize she wasn't counted in the last census. She hopes this year's count will mean more money for the local schools.
They are crowded, for one, and that is why I opted to take my child to a private school, because they get better attention there. But I would want him to go to a public school.
Muchemi sometimes works 16-hour shifts at a local hospital. She welcomes the chance to fill out the census online when it's convenient for her.
Probably if you come knocking on my door, you won't find me at home, unless you make an appointment or something like that. But if I can do it online, the better.
But the woman next to her is more apprehensive.
Most older person like me, I'm speaking for my age and up, you know. So they are not good in computer, you know.
Merlita Cash is from the Philippines. She says she might be more likely to fill out the census where she can get help. Cash works at a large military base nearby. She says her household suddenly jumped from 1 to 5 people this fall when her daughter and 3 grandchildren moved in following a divorce.
We're tight right now in the house.
Cash and her family have several risk factors for not being counted accurately, according to Pierce County Auditor Julie Anderson.
At risk in Pierce County is a 10% undercount of people of color, religious minorities, renters, children under the age of five, seniors who may be isolated in their homes. So those are all populations that are at risk of not getting counted if they don't receive special attention.
Anderson says that special attention includes small grants, so groups serving specific communities can host a meal or event to get the word out.
There's a census song that the kids can sing, and hopefully they'll sing it at home.
The census counts people in homes, big and small.
You count if you're tiny.
You count if you're tall.
Because everyone counts in the U.S. of A. Everyone
people will get an invitation to respond to the census in the mail next month. If they don't respond, then they'll receive paper forms and, as a last resort, a knock on the door. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Radel in Seattle.
We count all your neighbors and we count all your friends. Until we count you, the county won't.
Each of us is the star in the movie of our life. But how much of a role do we play in other people's movies?
It was a really sort of palpable fear that they were going to reject me or worse.
The unseen pressures we place on other people, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Last night's Democratic presidential candidates matchup is being called the messy debate.
Mr. Sanders,
let me go.
Tanya Mosley is leading our team in South Carolina. She'll anchor from there tomorrow. But producers spoke with audience members after the debate. D'Amica Weston says she's still undecided, but she liked the way moderates on stage aggressively went after the frontrunner Bernie Sanders.
You were weeding out the weakness. So I do think that strategy kind of helped. It helped weed out the weak from the strong.
Montrese Brown is also undecided. She noticed how often the candidates talked about issues important to the black community, but worried that attention won't last beyond Saturday's primary.
You know, it gets discussed so much during this time, and once the cameras are gone, you know, well, they're always gone once they're elected, but why aren't we discussing this 365? Like, that's a little concerning to me.
Let's bring in our political strategist joining us today, Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
And John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello.
Okay, so Bernie Sanders went into the debate with the momentum. Then this morning, Joe Biden got the endorsement of Jim Clyburn, a very influential black member of Congress in South Carolina. Angela, did the dynamics of the race shift at all last night or this morning?
I don't think so. Even with Congressman Clyburn, who's not only an influential member in South Carolina, but throughout the country as the majority whip for the House of Representatives, I think even with that, people either don't know and they won't know until they go cast their votes, or they know and they're dug in. Congressman Clyburn's own grandson, for example, is knocking on doors right now in South Carolina for Pete Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. So this is a very generational election where folks are picking their horses, so to speak, based on who speaks to them most and not necessarily based on the endorsement of someone they love and respect.
John Brabender, if you had to bet right now, who is going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party? We've got, of course, South Carolina and then Super Tuesday next week. Who is your bet for the nominee?
Well, what I would do is first I'd place a bet on South Carolina, which I would actually bet on Joe Biden. I actually think he will win South Carolina. But I actually give the lead right now to Bernie Sanders. I think one thing people aren't understanding quite yet about this election is the how the younger voters are going to change the electorate. Roughly 37-40% of the voters in the fall are going to be either Generation Z or millennials, and it's bigger in the Democrat primary. So when states like California coming up and so forth, you know, that's Bernie Sanders' land to get a lot of those voters, and I really believe he'll be the nominee.
Well, you know, you both mentioned generation, so I want you to listen to something. Bernie Sanders, of course, expected a pile-on, and he really got some of it with Pete Buttigieg. Let's listen.
Do we think health care for all, Pete, is some kind of radical communist idea? Do
Why
we think raising the minimum wage to a living wage?
To the question.
Do we think building... Really...
Well, it went on. And Angela, I heard someone watching with me say something like, come on, Mayor Pete, show some respect. They saw it as kind of Pete's OK Boomer moment to Sanders, the amount of times that he was talking over him. There is a generational divide here. Who won coming out of last night?
I don't know that I can pick a winner. I think if we go off of what the standards have been for debates during this primary season, it is the person who experiences the most amount of attacks, and that was very clearly Bernie Sanders. There were a number of candidates on the stage who wish to not only distance themselves, but distance the Democratic Party from what has been branded socialism. But as we know, Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist, which, you know, for some folks, that's semantics. For others, there's a very big distinction.
Well, there is a distinction. I mean, it doesn't mean changing the marketplace or getting rid of capitalism. It means more of a government safety net, right?
Right. Yeah. But all I'm saying is that people aren't choosing to listen to how he defines himself. They're instead choosing to brand him because they think he's the most dangerous. The reason why John, for example, I hate to put words in your mouth, but I suspect the reason why John is saying I see him as the front runner is because there are a lot of Republicans that hope he will be the front runner. So that's what we have, and that's where we are right now, and it is still too early to call.
Well, John, take that up. Is that do you have fingers crossed?
You know, we're being very cautious because I remember last time all my Democrat friends would say, oh, boy, please be Donald Trump, because there's no way Donald Trump's going to be president. Mm-hmm. And we have to understand that we're living in a different world now. And there's a reason Sanders is doing so well in national polls is because there's a certain segment of the population who feel like they're being left on the economic battlefield. They felt like they've been left that under for decades under both parties. And they see Bernie Sanders in many ways as a third party candidate that they're rallying behind. That's why I also don't think the hits on Bernie are going to resonate as much. Because they see him as a different type of candidate.
Just jump in to say, I just can't forget that when we were in Iowa in 2016, I called back hair on fire to say, I'm hearing a lot of people trying to decide then between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Because as you just said, John, they saw them both as disruptors. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's going to be a big part of what the rest of the Democrat primary is going to be. I mean, if you noticed last night, Biden went after Steyer, right? Why? Because he's playing for those voters. But if you look at Buttigieg, he went after Sanders a lot more. Why? He needs those voters. So also when you start seeing this attack back forth, understand why they're doing it and who they're targeting is purely to see what voters they can pick up.
John, you just don't like saying Democratic, do you?
I know. And I get called out on you know what? I only get called out on that on NPR. I think it's more of a
not on Fox.
It's not intentional. I just want you to know that. It's more a poor grammar.
Okay. So, let me ask you about something.
I don't believe you, John.
Okay. Angela, let me ask you this question about Pete Buttigieg last night. He made this point, which has been made by others, saying that Sanders as the nominee would be bad for down ballot races in the House and Senate. Listen.
Look, hello. If you want to keep the House in Democratic hands, you might want to check with the people who actually turned the House blue. 40 Democrats who are not running 41. On your platform. They are running away from your platform as fast as they possibly can.
Now, Angela, today Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, said that she would be okay with Sanders. She's not worried about that. But what do you think? Are you hearing that there would be concern among, you know, House and Senate Democrats running for election if Sanders is at the top of the ticket?
There will be concern from House and Senate Democrats if Bernie Sanders is at the top of the ticket. But there will also be concern from House and Senate Democrats if it's Buttigieg, if it's Warren, if it's Klobuchar. We have a big tent, and it is time for us to be called to the carpet on that. It is not a party that has a defining ideology. It is not a party anymore, and I don't know if it ever was, but there's finally this democratic process online, on digital, on social media, where people who don't have Bloomberg money but have a Bloomberg voice are being heard. And they're being called to the carpet on that. You even interviewed someone earlier in this segment where she says as soon as they're always gone after they're elected. That is a sentiment that is broadly shared, whether you are a black voter in South Carolina or you are a white blue-collar worker in Appalachia. It is time for elected officials of all at every level, but especially at the top, to be accountable to the people who they were talking to, pandering to, eating with, churching with, mm-hmm. you know, all of that, sitting down for interviews with throughout their terms, mm-hmm. not just during the election, and certainly not just during the primary.
Okay, I think if we look back on this conversation 10 years from now, depending on how things go with the coronavirus, we would be wrong not to talk about it. So let's just spend the last couple of minutes on that. John, what is at stake for President Trump tonight when he gives his press conference on this after a day of confusing messages yesterday? Trump said the coronavirus is very well under control. Hours later, his health secretary said there aren't enough masks and ventilators. The acting Homeland Security secretary couldn't answer basic questions about vaccines. And the stock market plummeted. What's at stake?
Yeah, well, the good news is my understanding the stock market is coming back up a bit. But with that said, what people really want to hear is they understand we're in uncharted territories. They want to understand, though, that this is something that is taking – the president's taking this as serious as it should be. They announced at the White House – I don't know if they made a decision – that they're thinking of assigning a specific health care czar to – handle this particular crisis by itself. I think people want to understand that there's a plan, they're taking it seriously, that they are planning for what could be the worst of it. And I think that's probably how the president will come across.
Well, Angela, do Democrats make a mistake by politicizing this now? I mean, John said, appoint somebody. Well, the CDC's been gutted, you know.
Right.
But if the Democrats go in that direction, you know, don't people want to see their lawmakers pull together as a team when there's a crisis?
There is no pulling together. We've been in crisis since he won in 2016, and I think this is just another one. There's been man-made disasters, and there's natural disasters and pandemics, and this is one of them. And I think the reality of it is we expect our leaders, regardless of political party and affiliation, regardless of ideology, to be both responsible and empathetic, and he has demonstrated time after time his inability to do that. He is not capable of doing what needs to be done in the highest office of the land, but yet here we are. And so there are other people, hopefully in his administration, who can hold his hand and help him get to the right side of this issue, which is protecting everyone on these shores and abroad.
And John, is there an additional concern with this president? You only have a few seconds, but he is a germaphobe. And there's been speculation he doesn't want to hear or talk about a virus.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that type of talk is ridiculous. I mean, the truth of the matter is the left does like to say, oh, this president, he doesn't have empathy or anything. There's a reason why right now most people think he's going to be reelected. People understand he has turned this economy around to a great economy. Mm-hmm. I think he needs to just demonstrate that he's going to treat this with the same seriousness he does the economy, and people will have full confidence.
Actually, Trump is losing against some of the top Democrats in some polls, but we will stay on this with Job Brabender, the Republican strategist, Angela Rye, the Democrat. Thank you both.
Thank you.
As Americans begin to absorb the CDC's latest warning to expect the coronavirus to get worse, travelers may have questions. What if, say, you have a vacation booked to Italy, where there are over 300 confirmed cases in the north? Let's bring in Seth Kaplan here now, transportation analyst. And Seth, you know, the CDC telling Americans to expect more aggressive restrictions as this virus spreads, maybe school closings, work closures. So, you know, are airlines expecting they're going to be disrupted?
Well, there are two ways they could be disrupted, and there's nothing special about air travel as compared to sort of anything else. It's just a lot of people together in a small space, right? So number one, you have the question, would there be restrictions? And that would probably come down to, you know, if a city is quarantined, which the CDC has said would be an extreme measure, you know, nothing they see anytime soon. The other question is just airline demand, right? You know, if people stop wanting to travel, then airlines will make their own adjustments, just that, like they always do in response to you know, people wanting to fly or not.
But you just said something so important. You said there's nothing special about airlines. And I'm sure people are thinking, no, airplanes, you're stuck with the same air. But I'm realizing in this research that in fact, people say that airplanes are safer. It's much more filtered air.
Yeah, it's the same kinds of filters that you would use in a hospital in terms of, you know, air going into to an operating room or whatnot. So it's you know, and that's an important, there's this myth about the air, as you said, on planes. It's the risk on a plane is the risk is the same as sitting with that same group of people in an auditorium, right, packed tightly together. No more, no less. So that person sitting next to you, if they're sick with whatever and they cough and the droplets get on you and all the rest of it, then yes, you're susceptible.
Right.
And that's really where it begins and ends in terms of air travel.
Well, I also didn't realize how much the airline industry had done research on exactly where to sit. Like, the window seat is safer, yeah, because you don't people don't pass you on the aisle. And also, they know how far to sit away from someone with TB, for instance. I think it's two rows or something. They have figured this out.
Yeah, a study from Emory University a couple of years ago, obviously not specific to the coronavirus, just in general. And the window, again, nothing magical about the window. It's just when you're sitting on the window, you're not surrounded by as many people. Also, people on the window apparently, whether they do this on purpose or not, don't tend to get up as much, right? Yeah. Because you have to climb over other people, just not around as many people.
Right. And you said if you're sitting next to someone, if you are, I was recently, you can go ask for another seat, or you can ask the personnel to help you help that person cough into their elbow or wipe up their area.
Yeah, and they'll do what they can for you. Yeah, the reality is you are in that space and on a very full flight, you have limitations. But absolutely, if you're concerned, speak up, as with anything else when it comes to air travel.
And I guess, yeah, in the few seconds we have, wash your hands. Wash the areas where you may have coughed, like a table tray. You know, just be smart about it.
Right. And masks, by the way, that's another question that's come up. Masks are important for people who are sick. Health authorities say generally they don't really help you if you're not sick. So you want to prevent those people from coughing on other people. If you're not already sick, it might just give you a false sense of security.
Right, because they can get through that mesh. And by the way, I also learned, don't ever brush your teeth with airplane water. There's problems with it. Do it with bottled water. Exactly. Here now is transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Thank you so much, as always, Seth.
Thanks, Robin.
Lawmakers in Utah this week moved a step closer to decriminalizing polygamy, or multiple marriages among consenting adults. Bigamy is currently a felony in Utah, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. But a bill recently passed by the state Senate and approved this week in a House committee would change that penalty to a fine and community service. V. Lowry Snow is a Republican in Utah's State House of Representatives. He's sponsoring the bill in the House. Representative, welcome. And what exactly would this bill do?
Well, I think you hit upon the most important point in your introduction. It reclassifies bigamy in the state from its current status as a third-degree felony to an infraction.
And there are still cases where, under your proposal, polygamy would still be considered a felony. What are those cases?
That's also a good point. We wanted to make certain that we retain those actions that we feel like rise to a higher criminal level, including a third-degree felony if the person marrying is under false pretenses, if a person is coerced or threatened into a bigamous relationship, and a second-degree felony if bigamy is part of sex trafficking, kidnapping, sexual offenses, including all of the child sexual offenses. We wanted to make certain that we retain serious charges for those offenses that might be related to a bigamy offense.
Wouldn't it be difficult to determine that, though, sometimes?
Well, I suppose it is in some cases, but that really goes to the heart of this legislation in that by decriminalizing or reclassifying bigamy itself is allowing those who may be victimized in those situations that I've referred to in coming forward and getting assistance.
Just to give our listeners some context for why this is an issue right now in Utah, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints disavowed polygamy in 1890, but there are still some fundamentalist Mormons who practice it. The sponsor of this bill in the state Senate, Deirdre Henderson, said the solution to the problem is increased societal integration, which can only come through decriminalizing otherwise law-abiding polygamists. Is that your intent with this bill, to bring polygamists back from the fringes of society?
I think to a large extent, and I share that view with her, but I would also say that in addition to this decriminalization, especially in my county, is the work that we've done in education. About 7 or 8 years ago, after Warren Jeffs was tried, convicted, and of course he's out of state serving time, we have made great strides in opening up that community. We opened up the public schools. We just recently had a ribbon cutting for a medical center where those folks previously did not have access to close medical care, and in some cases were afraid to seek medical care for themselves or their children based on this threat of prosecution. One of the more chilling parts of the research that I've done in this was a transcript, actually a recording of Warren Jeffs while he was still in power, so to speak, in that community, talking to a group, I believe, of fifth and sixth graders, where he was reminding them and telling them to talk to their parents about what happened during the Short Creek Raids of 1953, which is kind of a stain, I think, on the history of our nation, frankly, and on the history of Arizona and Utah. He reminds them that there is the threat always looming that they may be taken from their parents, that they could be isolated. And so part of this process of decriminalization, and it's only one part, is to bring sunlight, you might say, and an openness, an education to this community and others like it that have been shrouded or maybe involved in those who would use the law to control them in ways that are certainly not proper.
Now, critics of the bill point out that some women have been forced into polygamous relationships with older men and that any move to decriminalize the practice is putting people in danger by making the practice seem acceptable. What do you say to that?
I guess my response to that is this law has been a felony on the books since, 1935. I used to be a prosecutor in Washington County. We never brought a prosecution for bigamy. Law enforcement doesn't bring charges for bigamy. It goes really unreported, unenforced. And while I think I understand what the critics are saying, I think a better approach to helping our young people, especially that are growing up in these communities, is education and integration. My greatest concern is, and I've run several bills dealing with domestic violence, and I think by moving to a declassification, we're working towards allowing more light and more integration that potentially, I think, does away with that kind of influence that's being exercised.
What do you say to people who think this is a step toward legalizing polygamy?
Certainly not my intention, and the fact of the matter is we're not trying to legalize polygamy. The major thrust of this is to provide protection for those who may have been previously coerced into these situations.
The state's Republican-controlled Senate passed this bill unanimously, but it is expected to face a bigger hurdle in the House of Representatives. Do you think it will pass?
It's always hard to say until you're on the floor debating and see the votes go up. But I think early indications are generally their support. You know, in Utah, we undertook a few years ago a major declassification of criminal offenses. For example, we had on the books crimes relating to failure to register your boat as a Class B misdemeanor, which carried up to a six-month jail term. We reduced all of those to infractions. In addition, we reduced many of the crimes relating to drug possession to misdemeanors and outside of the felony range when they dealt with addiction and use rather than distribution. Utah's trying to approach criminal reform in a smart way and not utilize resources for areas that don't require that same level of attention. This is, in my mind, this is part of that. In the past, the bodies of both houses have been supportive of that kind of declassification.
Just one final question for you, Representative Snow. Do you have any friends who are polygamists?
I don't have any friends, but I've had associations with them from time to time. And that's the other point that should be made. There are many in our midst in southern Utah and throughout the state, but we especially see them in our midst in southern Utah. The ones that I have known and had any level of association with, I find to be law-abiding, who love their children deeply, who care about family issues, who are patriotic and law-abiding. I think also underlying some of the efforts to decriminalize is to counteract some level of, and this may be too strong a term, but some bigotry in Utah towards these people and towards these children. And I think while Utah has been terrific, and I congratulate our governor for welcoming refugees and taking that position, I think we need to take a look at all people, and to the extent that they deserve our respect and tolerance for the way they dress, for their beliefs, I think we could do better with that. There was really an unfortunate incident that occurred in southern Utah just a month or two ago. The charge indicated that this individual was going to go into a major grocery store in Cedar City, a community about 50 miles north of where I live, and, quote, shoot all the polygamists that he saw. Mm. I'm not saying that this bill addresses that issue specifically, but I will say that there has been a tendency among some of our residents to look at these people as second-class citizens and not afford them all of the same rights or protections that we might give other citizens. And this law should not be used as a license to promote that kind of bigotry.
That is V. Lowry Snow, a Republican in Utah's State House of Representatives, who is sponsoring a bill to decriminalize polygamy in the State House. Representative, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
More than 20 people are dead after three nights of rioting in India that coincided with President Trump's visit. Clashes between Hindus and Muslims broke out over a new fast-track citizenship law that excludes Muslims. During his visit, President Trump praised Modi as a leader who believes in religious freedom.
We did talk about religious freedom, and I will say that the prime minister was incredible on what he told me. He wants people to have religious freedom, and very strongly, and he said that in India they have worked very hard to have great and open religious freedom.
Let's bring in the BBC's Pratiksha Gildial in Delhi. Pratiksha, this is being described as the deadliest violence there in decades. What are you seeing?
Some really extraordinary scenes unfolded on the streets of northeast Delhi over the past 3 days or so. We saw extraordinary scenes of people being rushed to hospitals in their dozens. Black smoke billowing out of entire neighborhoods, mobs on the rampage, wielding sticks and stones, and people being targeted based on their religion. Really spine-chilling scenes. Now, parts of North Delhi still remain tense today, even though we haven't heard any fresh reports of violence today. But there are reports that the area is still pretty tense. There's an eerie calm in the streets and in the neighborhoods over there. There is a lot of destruction to property and businesses, especially Muslim businesses. People are staying indoors, and there is a heavy troop deployment. Now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi today, for the first time since the violence happened, appealed for peace and calm and said that he has personally taken stock of the situation and that the police and other paramilitary forces will be making sure that normality is restored soon.
He tweeted out, "Peace and harmony are central to India's ethos." But Pratiksha, for people just maybe tuning in the States to India and this issue for the first time, they may be saying, how can they do that? How can they fast-track citizenship for everybody but Muslims? Just tell us a little bit about this law. He is backing it, Modi is backing it, but what does it reflect right now in that country?
It's a really controversial law that has been introduced by India's government just in the last 2 months or so. It is a law that grants amnesty to illegal migrants from three neighboring countries of Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan, all Muslim-majority countries. But it will allow you to ask for Indian citizenship only if you are not a Muslim, because the government's argument is that they want to give protection and refuge to religious minorities that are fleeing from those three Muslim-majority countries. Of course, there are loopholes in this theory. Activists and critics say that if you are really, truly concerned about giving shelter to Muslims, then how about the Ahmadiyya community in Pakistan? How about the Rohingyas in Myanmar? But the government, for its part, says that they are not anti-Muslim and that India's Muslim population should not worry about this. But looking at the protests for the past couple of months or so, it doesn't seem to have people are not buying it.
And it has a whiff of President Trump's move to ban travel to the U.S. from Muslim countries, what's popularly called the Muslim ban. So I'm wondering, did these protests have anything to do with President Trump's visit and his support of Modi?
No, the protests themselves had nothing to do with President Trump's visit, but people in the administration are seeing it as some sort of a conspiracy stoked especially to get international attention during President Trump's visit. How it actually started was that a local BJP leader, BJP is the ruling party in India, asked the protesters who were protesting against this new law to vacate the streets. He asked the police to vacate the protesters. Otherwise, he said they will have to do something themselves. And then later in the day, news of clashes between communities started to emerge. And very soon it turned into a very ugly sectarian violence, with Hindus and Muslims engaging in pitched battles on the streets of Northeast Delhi. The situation today looks slightly better, but not that much under control.
And just briefly, is there any chance, given this violence, that law might be rescinded?
Well, at the moment, the government has been pretty firm that they are not going to resign the law, that it will stay in place. There is another very controversial program that the government has undertaken, which is called the National Register of Citizens, under which all Indian nationals have to prove their citizenship using papers and documentations. But seeing the protests, it'll be interesting to see whether the government will go ahead with that program. But as far as the citizenship law is concerned, the government is still firm on it.
The BBC's Pratiksha Gildial in Delhi. Pratiksha, thank you so much.
Bye for now, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
American Jesse Appel became a stand-up comic in China. He's now stuck in the U.S. because of COVID-19, so he's making Chinese students in the U.S. laugh with videos of people back home in quarantine training for the Olympics.
Weightlifting with boxes of beer and, like, curling with pots on the floor. And I felt like I was being a little help.
Next time, Here and Now.